Hi,
and welcome to Illumination by Modern Campus, your go-to podcast for conversations about transformation and innovation across higher education. I'm your host, Shauna Cox, and I'm excited to dive into today's conversation. Today, I'm speaking with John Rinoni, who is president of Mountain Gateway Community College. We explore how community colleges can redesign systems to remove barriers for students while building strategic employer partnerships that create clear pathways to workforce success. Let's get into it. John, welcome to the Illumination Podcast.
It's great to be with you today.
Absolutely. And as we were talking about earlier, before we hit record, you have been here maybe about 5 years ago, and it's definitely time to catch up and have some tangible conversations. So I'm going to kick off our conversation. We're going to talk about community colleges, of course. So as community colleges rethink their role in today's economy, what does it truly mean to move from being a student serving to a fully student ready institution?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And we could almost spend our entire time just on that one question. We have really thought about that over the last number of years. And the way we see this, it's really designing systems around students and their lives. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to, you know, the old adage is that the schedule is faculty friendly versus student friendly. The hours of our operations are staff friendly and not student friendly, et cetera. Okay. We are not 100% there, and we're still working. It's definitely an evolving process. One of those things I would say is flexible scheduling. We have just committed to moving. We will move 100%, but we are moving by next fall, by this coming fall. About 85% of our programs will all be 8-week terms.
Wow.
We still have some outliers that we're still working on some of the structural bases, as well as high flex delivery. So if nothing else, what taught us in COVID, post-COVID, is the need to deliver the programs in a much more flexible manner. So at post-COVID, pretty much all our classes were in a high flex manner. So if you did not feel well, we wanted you to stay home, but you could still participate in class at the same time. Okay. Now, what that led to was we would have a class of 25 and there would be 3 students in front of the student live and the other 22 would be online. So it did lose some of that interaction there, but that was really what one of the pieces we felt that the students were telling us that that's what we needed to do for flexibility. We know community colleges students, the most very high percentage of first generation college students. I was a first generation college student, you know, working multiple jobs, family, and so forth. So they need flexibility. They need to be able to be flexible. Mm-hmm. Another thing, integrating advising. So a lot of times, even for registration, we actually go to the class. The faculty gives us time. Our advisors go to the class and register for the students in that class, especially if it's a cohort type of even nursing. We have a forestry program. So we know exactly what your classes are for the next semester. And then even the whole idea of the one door process. We have come a long way with the one door process where we're a relatively small campus. We are small and rural in Virginia. We are not quite 100% there for one door, but a lot of our services, we really try to customize our services to what the students need. So I know my staff is sick of me saying, well, that's another boulder in the way of students. Okay. That's another barrier for them. How can we break that down? Now, sometimes we live in a rules society and we can't knock them all down because of federal for financial aid and various types of things. But what can we do locally that can really help that student? So it's really designing systems that are meaningful for the student versus meaningful for the college. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I want to expand on the idea of building systems for the students and ask how can institutions redesign their systems, the experiences to proactively remove those barriers rather than expecting their students to just kind of navigate everything on their own?
Honestly, sometimes I think you need to be a future teller too. You know, you have to really try to anticipate some of those needs and really strengthening those particular supports. On the other side, I've been president here for, I'm finishing my 13th year, and I've done things like pizza with the president. I do it twice a semester, and it's just asking the students questions. You know, I wish this was available, or I wish that was available. And I'll give you a really simple thing that happened very early on. We had a lot of older students who were attending, and you know, they were on a fixed income and limited resources. And they said, you know, we come and we bring our water bottles, but there's no place to actually fill, get ice, be able to, you know, and the water that comes out of the fountains is not really cold. And subsequently, we actually have water bottle fountains now instead of just sinks. So, you know, that one piece, we were able to take funds out of student activities, and we got an ice machine. Really simple type of thing, but it was like I gave them, you know, gold medal. It just was that simple thing. If we didn't talk to students, we would never have known that. We were one of the early ones, probably 10 years ago, that actually had a food pantry. Okay. It started out very different. We actually have now something called a Roadrunner Cafe. Our nickname is the Roadrunners. It is open as long as the college is open. Anyone can go there. Faculty, staff, students. There's things from cereal in the morning. There's bottles of water. There's protein bars. We have had grant money and private dollars. We have also had industry partners who have given us $2,500 to support an entire month for those types of things. Okay. Ultimately, the barrier is to try to remove those friction points, okay, that we would have. And obviously, and I know all of your listeners for community colleges, we obviously have emergency funding as well. So the emergency funding of pay a gas bill, pay rent, a flat tire, you know, those types of things. We have simplified the process. This is another barrier. I said very clearly, we can have a lot of money, but I don't want it to be like you were purchasing a home to get $500. It's a simple form for us to keep track, but we do not want to put another barrier in the student's way when they're dealing with trying to pay their rent.
Absolutely. I love that. And it's not just the barriers to the academics, it's the whole student experience. Because if they're having troubles financially, if they don't know where their breakfast is coming from or their next meal is coming from, then that's going to distract and disrupt their academic and that whole journey. So I love that you guys are really taking a holistic
Absolutely.
approach there.
Absolutely. Yep.
So from the student journey in the academic programming, that whole life cycle, of course, a component to the programming is going to involve employers and how students have that connection right into the workforce. So, on the programmatic side of things, what differentiates a transactional employer relationship from a sustainable strategic partnership that is going to drive long-term value for the learners and the institution?
So there's a couple of things. Anything transactional is, in my mind, kind of a temporary type of thing. So, you know, in leadership, we talk about transactional versus transformational. So in this case, it's transactional versus strategic, you know, employer partnerships. You know, transactional will fill a job immediately, and we're kind of just treated like a placement agency. Okay. But ultimately, a partnership, and we feel like we have partnerships with a lot of our employers because number one, they serve on our program advisory committees. Okay. And I ask every single year to our faculty, How many of your program advisory committee members have hired our graduates? And if they can't come close to 80%, then we probably have the wrong people sitting around the table. Okay? Because they are going to tell us, your graduates are wonderful. I wish that they had this skill. Okay? It also making sure that we align the education experience with real workforce needs. And being able to tie all of that. And we use the program advisory committees. A number of us on the college serve on economic development, workforce development committees, from chambers to regional partnerships. Because, I'm part of like a rapid response team. So if an potential employer is looking to move into the area and they're coming to town tomorrow, we may not even know what the company is because it's all confidential. But the first question that they ask is, I'm going to need to hire 100 people. Can they be trained and will you help recruit over any even tax incentives or other types of incentives to get them here? They're worried about workforce. They're worried about the trained workforce. On the other side is when they see that this is a strategic partnership. I'm going to wear my fundraising hat now. It does lead for donations and partnerships for equipment, for facilities, okay, for expansion of programs where they may even pay for another welding instructor. So the strategic partnership is not only on our side, but it's also on the employer side that they know that they have a long-term permanent talent pipeline with us, okay, that can truly be a partnership. Because, my message to employers who have been very happy with our graduates and see the productivity that our graduates have is, how many dollars would that have saved if versus recruiting? Okay. And we're going to ask you for a $25,000 piece of equipment, to help us purchase this piece of equipment. Or $25,000 that will go into scholarships to expand this particular program because we have more dollars than what's available for students. And my experience has been that in many cases, employers just hand over the money because they see it as an investment and not just writing a check.
Absolutely. And dovetailing off of the, rapid response team that you mentioned earlier, there is kind of two components to programming of answering the demands of the industry right away because those are constantly evolving. And at the same time, from an institutional standpoint, you can look at the idea of sustainability and that long-term relationship as learners come in and out of the institution. So I'm wondering, how can community colleges align their workforce programs with those evolving employer needs while still supporting those long-term learner mobility along with the institutional strategy that you have?
So this is an old term and a new term, and it will be a future term. Is I use the it's pathways. It's pathways, pathways, pathways. Okay. I started in continuing education and workforce, so I always feel like, continuing ed is lifelong learning. Okay. The pathways, and we're fortunate in Virginia that we have General Assembly funding around a program called Fast Forward, which is industry that creates pays for two-thirds of a industry-recognized credential, such as our commercial driving license, CDL, our phlebotomy program, our certified medical assisting program, et cetera. Okay. Well, all of those, when we started to offer those types of programs, a number of years ago, we came back and it was actually myself, my chief academic officer, and at the time, it was our chief student affairs officer. The three of us locked ourselves in my boardroom for half a day and said, we're not leaving until we can basically look at how we can redesign our programs and then go to the faculty with the plan. Most colleges think about industry clusters and meeting needs along this way, okay? Along left to right. And if you think about high school, There, typically, most Department of Eds have 16 industry clusters. Okay. Some of them overlap, like marketing is a separate one with business. In most colleges, marketing and business are in the same one. We had about 13 of those clusters based on our needs. Okay. We offered programs in roughly 12 or 13 of those clusters. It was our feeling that we did not need to grow left to right. We needed to go top to bottom. Okay. Because what was happening was we had sub degrees, we had certificates, and in Virginia, there's something called career studies certificates, okay, which are shorter term, no gen eds, but really just welding classes type of thing. Okay. And you earn a college credential. Along with within those courses, they would be industry credentials. However, what was happening was the career studies certificate was not matching up with the certificate, and the certificate was not matching up with the degree. So students were in their own institution moving up a ladder and losing credits along the way. Okay. And we said that, and honestly, a lot of programs, and this was definitely pre-COVID, so I'd say 8, 9 years ago, we had sequencing that was just really did not make any sense. Every college has a student development class, which is typically taken in the first semester. In some cases, it has to be done in the first 6 or 8 credits. Some of our programs listed that course as the last course in their program. So when we did an analysis, and I'll use one program, our criminal justice program, we had at least 25 students who never officially graduated because they were all 1 credit short because they never took that course.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily advocated to take the course from the department head, et cetera. And the advising was not, and the limited advising was not the right way at that point. Okay. Well, we were able to revamp everything and we put courses in order. And that was right around the time that redesigning America's Community College book from the Community College Research Center came out. So we had the evidence now of what we were
Yeah.
kind of talking about. All right. So that really created that those credentials. Now, even our CDL program, if somebody completes that, we've just developed a logistics and transportation career studies certificate. A student completes that CDL, they'll earn 9 college credits, go into the career studies certificate into logistics and transportation. And if they want to be able to use that into a general degree called technical studies, there's a pathway for them. Okay. And in most cases, they might be interested if they're going to just stop at truck driver, which is, by the way, our largest program by numbers. Okay. That's all they need. But if they want to start supervising, they want to be, even potentially own a truck driving company down the road, we have a pathway and the student's not going to be able to lose, okay, lose any of the credits. What that does is it really ensures that students can enter the workforce quickly and really continue to maintain options. We have a number of options even under for example, our business program. We were able to eliminate some degrees and now we have basically their majors under our business management degree program. Okay. You can get a small business emphasis, you can get a nonprofit emphasis, and all of them lead directly into our management program. All of these lead to certificates, degrees, and really in career advancement.
Which is amazing because you are providing so many options for them, but they don't have to take everything. It's at least, for right now, if that's what they want to do, They can stay as a truck driver and then maybe come back in the future and then work the way up if that's what they choose to do. There's not one
Absolutely.
commitment right away. And just being mindful of time, I know we have 3 minutes left, but I just have one last question for you. I want to look at the big picture. So looking ahead, what will define the community college that will successfully connect student readiness with that workforce readiness at scale? Big
Yeah.
question.
Another wizard question. Like, try.
Yeah.
I kind of look at the successful community colleges need to integrate all of those things that we've talked about: student-centered design, workforce alignment, strong partnerships at scale. Okay. And ultimately, it connects access, completion, and employment outcomes. And obviously, using data. Data, and being able to be flexible in delivery and really have a deep commitment to both the community and the economic impact of the college, our colleges into each one of our communities.
Amazing, John. Those are all the formal questions I have for you. But my bonus question that I would love to ask is if somebody is looking to pick up a book, what is a good book recommendation for them?
I have a couple, but the one I'm reading right now is, and I just learned about it a couple of weeks ago. So I do a lot of books on tape. So this is the Injustice of Place. It's about poverty. It's looking at poverty and how all of us are looking at programs that meet that family-sustaining wages. And this is really a very interesting, and there's multiple authors on this, but it's The Injustice of Place, and it really kind of looks at two or three specific communities and how I'm only about halfway through at this point, but it really talks about how poverty affects a lot of things and how really our roles as community colleges, we can really bring those individuals to the middle class, being able to get them to the middle class. So that would be a book I would definitely recommend. I also, if I may, have a little bonus. I was fortunate that myself and a great friend of mine co-authored a book on fundraising for community colleges called Catalyst for Change: How Fundraising Powers Student Success and Community College Transformation. Yes, you can find it on Amazon and so forth. And but the how important, and some of the things I even alluded to, a lot of this is critical on raising additional dollars because of state declining funding overall and still trying to keep our tuition very affordable. The gap always has to be through private dollars, and it is really a look at a role. There are many institutions who are very mature in the fundraising area, and then there are many institutions that really have not necessarily looked at fundraising. So this could help really all types of individuals. So thanks for letting me put in that shameless plug as well.
Absolutely. I love it. Well, you alluded to fundraising in our conversation, so I think it ties beautifully. John, thank you so much for the book recommendations and for the conversation. It was great chatting with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me today.
This podcast is made possible by a partnership between Modern Campus and The Evolution. The Modern Campus Engagement Platform powers solutions for non-traditional student management, web content management, catalog and curriculum management, student engagement and development, conversational text messaging, career pathways, and campus maps and virtual tours. The result? Innovative institutions can create learner-to-earner life cycle that engages modern learners for life, while providing modern administrators with the tools needed to streamline workflows and drive high efficiency. To learn more and to find out how to modernize your campus, visit moderncampus.com. That's moderncampus.com.